Good morning, everybody. Such a pleasure to be here. I love our time together. Thank you for coming. So, if there is anybody I haven't met before, I'm happy to meet you. Like Carlita said, my name's Heidi Born. I've been teaching for a while. I live up in Northern California, up in the Redwoods, on the land of the Wiat. It's raining, it's gray. It's very wintry here, but it is not freezing like it is in a lot of other places. Take a look at each other. You know, if you don't have your video on, if you can turn it on for just a couple of moments, that would be great. Just to greet each other with kind eyes, a kind heart. Nobody knows who's looking at whom when. It's just so sweet to see each other. What a pleasure. Well, how lovely. Isn't it great? You know, this is what Sangha does. It's open to anybody who wants to be here whenever it works for you. So welcome, welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure. So how our morning will go is that we'll start with an arriving meditation shortly. I'll offer a short little Dharma talk, a little Dharmet to give us something to think about. We'll have a longer meditation. We'll probably have a little break, another talk, tons of group discussion. I love it when we talk with each other. I think that that's the richest place for learning, is when whoever wants to offer thoughts or questions or reflections brings that into the group. So that's how our morning will go. Let's find a posture to start in meditation for our arriving, a place to settle, to make that transition from everywhere we've all been, from everything that we have been doing already today to coming into now. Taking a couple of very deliberate breaths to arrive and settle. You can close your eyes if you like, or have a soft gaze downward, whatever works for you. Let's see if you can sit in a way that supports staying attentive, but not stressed, invites a quality of relaxation. Maybe getting a sense of feeling your body from the inside out, which invites the body to sit in a clear way, to let your posture adapt to what the body is asking for, whether it's seated, reclining, standing, whether your back is touching the back of a piece of furniture, a chair or a couch, or whether you're more centered or a little bit forward in the chair, balanced on the sit bones. You might notice different kinds of sensations, maybe the pressure of the body on its seat. The awareness, the sense of being upright and balanced. How do you know you're sitting? What are the sensations or the perceptions? If you're reclining, how do you know you're reclining? Getting a sense of the length of the body, the width of the body, the sense of the body in space. You might notice texture and tone of the body through the sensations of the hands, maybe around the eyes, the forehead, maybe the mouth and jaw. Balancing this awareness of the body, coming into some sort of balance, balanced awareness of the body, quality of relaxation, attentive yet relaxed. And then becoming aware of the breathing, its rhythm, its quality. Not doing anything to change it in any way. Just aware of this breathing body. Awake and alive in the body. Awake and alive in the breathing. Aware of being here. Placing the awareness somewhere in the body that feels most natural, most accessible to you, might be the way you sense the breath going in and out of the body, or the sensation in the feet, maybe the seat, the hands, anywhere. But for the next few minutes, very intently, deliberately, but gently placing your attention where it can rest, where you can stay there for a few minutes, quietly, steadily, just here. And in the here-ness, sensing into the space of the heart, inviting the heart to be present with whatever is happening in this moment. Maybe even placing a hand on the chest to sense the warmth of your own body touching itself. Breathing in a little ease. Breathing out peace. cultivating an intention towards ease and peace for right now. This is a poem from Meister Eckhart called Love Does That. All day long, a little burro labors, sometimes with heavy loads on her back, and sometimes just with worries about things that bother only burros. And worries, as we know, can be more exhausting than physical labor. Once in a while, a kind monk comes to her stable and brings a pear. But more than that, he looks into the burro's eyes and touches her ears, and for a few seconds, the burro is free. It even seems to laugh, because love does that. Love frees. Welcome back. Good morning again. So I've been thinking lately about some of my favorite lessons or teachings from the Buddha, and what are these teachings that I have found over time that keep supporting me, that I come back to over and over again, and there are many of them. But I want to talk today a little bit about in this first part of the talk, I want to talk about how we manage our minds, how we stay in relationship to the quality of mind, the state of mind, and how easy it is to get hijacked. You know, there's so much stimulation, there's so much going on worldwide, and it is very easy to, I think, be overstimulated, to be caught in the, the next outrage, the next scary thing, the next event, violent event. And I think what we need to do is keep cultivating over and over a steadiness to be able to be with what is out in the world. And this is the refuge of our practice, I believe, that really gives us this capacity. So I want to talk a little bit about how we stay with a steady mind. So here's some selections from the Dhammapada. And the Dhammapada is a beautiful, beautiful, small book of teachings of the Buddha that are in verse. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's just a tiny little book full of beautiful teachings that are worth reflecting on. So here are first a few of them that we will take into the rest of our time together today. The very first, I believe this is the first teaching in the Dhammapada, speak or act with a corrupted mind and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. Speak or act with a peaceful mind and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. The mind hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. And somewhere in there he says, the warped mind is always on fire. So this is what I think the Buddha is pointing to here, is that the nature of greed and ill will and delusion and the forces around them are so easy to corrupt the mind. It's so easy for us to get hijacked into whatever the next difficult thing is. It's just how the mind works. And so our training over and over again recognizes that The mind is flighty. It is hard to control. It goes where it wants. We do, this practice is a practice of taming our awareness. And it can be difficult. It can be hard to see when we're caught and we're off somewhere. But I love this line that says, the sage protects the mind. The watched mind brings happiness. And I feel that, and I hope you do too, that the more we engage in this discipline of awareness, of seeing what is here, of cultivating a wise response to whatever is going on, we know the mind is hard to control, but maybe it's not so much controlling the mind, but having more pliancy to respond to whatever is happening in the mind. And part of the control might be, what do we expose ourselves to? What are we taking in? And I'm certainly not promoting, let's just put our heads in the sand, but I am saying, be aware of what you expose yourself to. And the Buddha goes on to say, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. And I love that. And I go back to it over and over again because the instructions are clear. Avoid what is unskillful. Well, this is a training in knowing the difference, but I think oftentimes we find out the difference between skillful, unskillful, wholesome, and unwholesome. Do what is good, right? Do what is good. Train the heart, mind, our whole life in the direction of helpfulness, of friendliness, and certainly towards ourselves. And purify the mind. That is the training of uprooting greed and ill will and cultivating clarity. And we do this through the training in meditation is one way. This is the teachings of the Buddha. And here's a part, the last one of the Dhammapada that I want to bring to you that I think is so reassuring. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. Isn't that beautiful? Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. And what I love about this so much is I think that it inherently recognizes our diversity. It's whatever path of action you find. And we all, you know, how many paths of good action does this world need? Do our families and communities need? Many different paths of action. And so we all don't take up the same cause. We all don't do the same thing, but when we all work towards the good, it has a really big effect because we'll all reach somebody who needs to be reached, including ourselves. So I'm just going to read those to you again. I think that they're pith teachings. Speak or act with a corrupted mind and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. Well, that's really logical, isn't it? I mean, this is not rocket science. It makes so much sense. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. Though the mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. This is the wisdom that grows when we understand suffering and the end of suffering. And it takes a lot of work, right? We keep coming back to this practice over and over again to be reminded that when my mind is in a grip, I'm less likely to see clearly. I'm more likely to be swept away by the forces of greed and ill will. And obviously to different degrees. But before we can do any of these trainings, what I do think the Buddha is asking of us is to first know the state of mind that is present. And that's the third foundation of mindfulness of the mind. Munindraji, one of Jack Kornfield's teachers, said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. Can we do that? Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but this is the practice. Sit down and observe it in a way that has some space around it. Not because we're looking for a certain state of mind or trying to shift it in a way, but necessarily to start with, what is it like now? What is happening in this mind? Can I be with the chattery mind, the restless mind, the sad mind, the whatever it is we are training to be with the mind? And this is where we get to really the pith, another pith teaching, maybe the unsung hero of the Eightfold Path, of wise effort. And wise effort, you know, we know about, we start with these path factors, wise intention, wise attention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. It's easy to float right over wise effort. But wise effort might be this underground place that really supports the rest, which is knowing and responding to the various states of mind, heart in skillful and wholesome ways. So we have to be attentive. So this practice of mindfulness of the mind takes us into, all right, now I know what the state of mind is. What am I going to do about it? Am I going to support it, or is it something that needs to be disentangled? And I think wise effort is a quality of ballast. It holds us. Sometimes I think about wise effort as a quality of accompaniment. What is with me? What is holding me? It's almost like, and there are a lot of metaphors for this, but it is that quality that is a little bit of a barometer. If I can know what is the state of my mind, I can have more access to how is that state of mind affecting everything around me. So just to take wise effort apart a little bit, the knowing of the states of mind and then responding appropriately. So the Buddha said that there are four great efforts or four great endeavors within wise effort. And the first is when a truly difficult state of mind is present that leads to unskillful action. We want to prevent that. We want to start with preventing those states from arising in the first place. And we can't always, right? I mean, this is like, you know, the Dalai Lama talks about wise effort as being akin to how do we take care of the physical body, the way we prevent illness. We have habits of living that help us prevent getting sick, but sometimes we do. So we start with prevention, and we start with prevention through all of the ways that we cultivate skillful, wholesome, disciplined ways of being in our lives. And that's why I said earlier, what are we exposed to and how does that affect us? So we prevent these states of mind from arising through our practice, but it doesn't always work, right? It just doesn't always work, because what happens is the grump does arise. The frustration does arise, or there's some state of mind that we actually, you know, we kind of lose our ballast and we say or do something that we wish we hadn't done because we're frightened or anger arises, any of those things. So when that does arise, the practice is to recognize it and let it go. Not so easy, right? We know that it's not so easy to just get ungrumpy. Sometimes it takes tracking back, takes me tracking back. Oh, where did this come from? And seeing what is it that is feeding this? So in order to know the grump, the clench, I want to work to let that go. We'll talk more about that after the meditation. And the third of these efforts is to cultivate wholesome, balanced states of mind, to know what are those things that you do in your life that really help do that. You know, for me, one is getting enough sleep. Things like that that are basic. And it is also exposure to whatever the stimuli are. But like, what do you do to help your body stay balanced and healthy? It's the same thing with mind states. And then when you know you're doing well, when you know that things are really okay, totally, whether it's, you know, this is specific to the mind, but let's just say the whole being is in a good place. What do you do to enhance that? Keep doing what is working. And so over and over again, these teachings come back to suffering and the end of suffering, finding out what supports the well-being and continuing to do that, being willing to see what increases suffering or maintains suffering, and letting go of those habits that don't support us. So I think that wise effort is the ground of so much of how we can be in our lives in a more skillful, kind, loving way. So how this works in meditation practice, meditation, I believe, is a practice that is training ground. It's a training ground for how we are, how we can show up in our lives, that most of us here are probably not monastics, that we're lay practitioners, and we include meditation in our lives as a habit because it supports our well-being. I know that in the training of meditation and training my own, in my own capacity to stay with, to follow through a breath, beginning, middle to end, not get distracted, to just stay with that, is a parallel to what do I commit to in my life that I stay with? How do I stay with a difficult conversation? How do I stay? And that's this training that we're doing. And it requires a willingness to be present to whatever arises, literally breath by breath. And the knowing of a long breath, a short breath, a shallow breath, a deep breath, it is not so we become experts at the different parts of the breath. It's so we train in being present with, oh, this is what it's like right now. And we need a persistence, right? This is part of wise effort, is to stay with it. But if we can have the persistence be gentle, it's much more inviting to recognize our humanity, that we're, you know, our minds are going to be all over the place. We're going to have all kinds of energies that come and go into the heart. This is just natural. But in the literal meditation, I will say to myself, gentle persistence, come back, feel the breath, relax, begin again. And those are not said in my inner voice in a harsh way at all. It's not judgmental at all. It's actually giving myself that guidance. Oh yeah, remember, come back, take a breath, notice it, begin again. Whatever words you want to use is a training in sticking with it, is a training in wise effort. What is here? All right, what is the appropriate response? So using any of those kinds of words, just getting the internal sense of what those words are, it redirects my efforts and buoys up my energy, because then I'm present and I am engaged with the practice of meditation itself, and it has a quality of strengthening my resolve or my momentum. And it's just 20 or 30 minutes. It's not for a long time that we're asking of ourselves. I mean, you may have a practice that you do meditate for 45 minutes, 60 minutes, different amounts of time, whatever the amount of time is that you've dedicated. Maybe it's open-ended. You're just going to sit down and stay there until it's clear that the meditation is over. You're just doing it for that period of time. And it requires a continual adjustment and fine-tuning, just like life. But we stick with it. And that is what the wise effort asks us to do, is to stick with it, to notice what's here, and to adjust accordingly. Are there any questions on that? Okay, let's move into a meditation. We'll be here for about 20 minutes. You know, the other thing occurred to me as I was saying that I just want to pop in here. When I said, you know, however long you meditate for, maybe this is your weekly meditation when you come to Sangha, and depending on who's here, whether it's Sylvia or Donald, or if I'm here, it's different amounts of time. And it's not to say that there's a magic amount of time. What's important is the consistency. And it might be for you that you set a timer because you know that a timer works for you. For me, I've never set a timer. And it's been a very organic process of sitting down for meditation and just letting the meditation unfold in its own way. And what ends up happening for me very often is that it's about 30 minutes, quite naturally, that's just the rhythm that I'm in. And sometimes it's shorter, sometimes it's longer, because it just is. But I want to say that to you, that as you are in your own meditation practice, you might try not turning a timer on and let this open up in its own way without expectation. Just sit down and see what happens next, because that is the practice of equanimity, of trust, of confidence, that you can just sit down, be in your meditation, just be there. Just be there. Okay. So let's find again a posture that you know that works well in your body. No forcing. Sitting, standing, reclining in a way that supports you, that the mind is attentive and present, that the heart is also present and responsive. Letting the body be comfortable. And for this meditation, beginning with placing some awareness in the base of the body, maybe deep in the belly, the bottom, the sit bones, the legs. And if you like, imagine sending roots down from the base of the body down into the earth. Roots that grow wide and deep, that are strong and flexible, that provide stability, strength, and sustenance. They're the kind of roots that allow you to move and sway and adjust and flex, but you're also held right here. On your next exhale, imagine exhaling down through the body, down into the roots, down into the earth. And as you inhale, inhaling up earth energy, nourishment, up these roots and into your whole being, as high up as it wants to flow. And then exhaling back down into the earth through the roots. This reciprocal relationship, receiving, releasing, receiving, and giving. This is the earth's breath. It's very grounding, very nurturing. You can come back to this breath. You can stay with this breath anytime and for as long as you like. Staying present, aware, and holding just enough energy in the back of the body to support your presence, your awakefulness, the aliveness. And then inviting the whole front of the body to soften towards a quality of receptivity. And then finding that place where you can rest your attention that really works for you, whether it's staying with the breath right where you feel it the most in your body, staying with this earth's breath, if that works for you, or perhaps sensation, hands, feet, anywhere. Or maybe it's your metta practice. Whatever it is, choose that and stay with it in a gentle, persistent way. So when the mind floats off and you know it, come back, take a breath, arrive and settle again. Begin again, and we'll sit for a bit. Noticing if there's anywhere that is holding or tight, maybe a habitual place. Could be the forehead or the jaw, maybe the belly. Maybe the hands are tight, wherever it might be, if it's there, might not be. Sending some softening energy to that space, nurturing every part of your whole being, whatever state it's in. Breathing there. Relaxing again, any amount. Now, if it works for you, see if you can closely sense into the experience of breathing in, knowing you're breathing in oxygen, and then breathing out the carbon dioxide. This exchange that happens on its own, but we can become much more aware of it. The receiving and the giving, the receiving and the releasing. Sensing into that for a few rounds of breath. And just like the earth's breath, bringing some awareness to the heart. And imagine breathing into the heart space from every direction, nourishing all the nooks and crannies of the heart space. And then breathing out, back out into every direction from the heart, offering out your goodness and also giving away what you don't need. This is the heart's breath. And if you like, thinking back to a time in relationship with anybody where somebody else did something lovely for you, some act of generosity, of care, of seeing you. What was that like to receive somebody else's care and goodness? Letting that fill you in some way, the memory of being the recipient of somebody else's caring. And then the opposite, remembering a time where you were able to offer care to somebody else. What that was like. The giving. Visualizing and sensing into this giving and receiving. You might sense it in the heart, in the body, in the mind. The state of mind that arises from the memory of giving and receiving. Just being with that for a few moments. Coming back to the body, letting any imagery go. Being here. Here is a poem called "When Giving Is All We Have" by Alberto Rios. One river gives its journey to the next. We give because someone gave to us. We give because nobody gave to us. We give because giving has changed us. We give because giving could have changed us. We have been better for it. We have been wounded by it. Giving has many faces. It's loud and quiet big, though small, diamond in wood nails. Its story is old, the plot worn in the pages too, but we read this book anyway, over and again. Giving is, first and every time, hand to hand, mine to yours, yours to mine. You gave me blue and I gave you yellow. Together we are simple green. You gave me what you did not have, and I gave you what I had to give. Together, we made something greater from the difference. So thinking about, again, anybody, any being who you would like to offer some metta to, knowing the beauty in this offering of goodwill. Maybe bringing that person or non-human being into your mind's eye, wishing them safety and peace, strength and ease. And then when you hear the sound of the bell coming back, all right. So I wanted to set the ground for us today in thinking about wise effort, because I do think it is a grounding practice. It is a place out of which so much else can happen, and specifically how we cultivate the heart. And you might know that in our practice, there's this beautiful list of the mature expressions of the heart called the paramis. And I like to think about how we can grow the paramis out of the ground of wise effort. Because how do we connect? There are all these beautiful flavors, facets of the heart that I'll talk about shortly, but it's not always so easy to just say, oh, my heart is open, my heart is tender, I can actually show up with compassion. It can be difficult. And I think that when it's grounded in awareness and grounded in wise effort, that it makes more sense. It's got a way to be grounded. It's just that simple. So, you know, oftentimes we think about what is mindfulness, what is heartfulness. And I think that what happens is that when we connect awareness with the heart is when we get the full expression of what mindfulness is, or what Ram Dass said as loving awareness. So I want to read to you, I'm going to read this list of paramis, and you may know them very well. This might be well woven into your own practice, or this might be new for you. But pause and listen in. You might even close your eyes as you hear each one of these paramis listed. Paramis, again, the perfections of the heart, mature expressions of loving awareness. And as you hear each one of these paramis, notice if you get that sense of, I want that. That's the one that's drawing me. Or is there a sense of, that's completely unavailable, I don't even know what that is. Just notice your own response to these paramis. Maybe there's one that's well integrated that you've worked with a lot. So closing the eyes, if you like, sense the body. First one, generosity. Morality. Renunciation. Wisdom. energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, equanimity, generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, equanimity. I wonder if you would be willing to say what struck you, what resonated, what didn't. We can do it in the chat, or we can do it by unmuting. I'd love to hear what is the one that drew you, or is there one that pushed you away? Anybody? Allison, please.
It's funny because I'm consistently drawn to loving kindness. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, okay. But this time, patience was very acute for me.
Very alive, yeah.
And I think that that's really different for me because I'm very much a person who I'm like, my friends say I'm a go-getter, like I like to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel such a strong calling in my practice recently to just receive.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful.
That is so, I'm just recognizing how connected that is to patience and allowing. And I think even part of my attraction to loving kindness is that it feels active. So the idea of just sitting and receiving patiently.
Isn't patience can be a very active practice also. Yeah. That my favorite definition of patience comes from Ajahn Suchito, who says that patience is the ability to relax the edges of time to make space for something else to arise.
Wow.
Isn't that great? To relax the edges of time to make space for something else to arise. So it's an active engagement to abide, to relax those edges. So I encourage you to look into patience more, since that's the one that's alive for you. Wonderful. Who else? What did you notice? Anybody? Sharon, please. Hang on a sec. Let's get you unmuted.
Okay. I'm not sure what renunciation means, but it sounds like something I do not want to do.
Okay, so isn't that just great? Because what my question is like, what's hooking you? Like, where is, like, something you can't quite name? It sounds like something I don't want to do. So the practice of renunciation is the letting go, the simplification, the releasing of maybe whatever you don't need, or maybe whatever it is that you'd like to let go of, to let be, a habit that might not support you. But it also could be a view, you know, fixed views, things that, or releasing, renouncing the view of a certain view. This is complex and it's beautiful, and we will talk about it next month when I'm back. So just noticing, all right, I'm going to look into what is renunciation. Yeah, thank you, Sharon. Nancy.
On the subject of renunciation, I had the opposite reaction. It's on my mind right now because, as you know, in DPP, we're studying the aggregates as the source of suffering. And one of our exercises was to take a situation which was kind of stressful for us and evaluate it in terms of the aggregates. And as I was going through that, that analysis, what I realized is that I needed to let go of my anger about the situation, and I needed to let go of my view of what had occurred and what was right and what was wrong about it. And so for me, renunciation in some contexts can have a negative vedana to it, a negative feeling to it, but renunciation can also have a positive effect, because once I let go of the anger, once I let go of my view, the suffering was gone.
So brilliant. I'm so glad you said this, because this is the intention of our practice, right? Is to release suffering, to be able to work with, oh my God, I can do that and the suffering goes away. And it doesn't mean that the thing that caused the anger to arise isn't still there. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's that relationship. And so, yeah, I totally get what you mean. And I think that renunciation can work on both ways. Like, it can be a challenge and it can also be a relief. Lily. See if we can get you unmuted, Lily. There you go. You are.
Hi. So generosity is like a longtime friend who comes to greet me often.
So it's easy for you? Is it an access point? Beautiful. Generosity is a longtime friend who comes to greet me often. That's beautiful. Thank you. And I did see the question in the chat. What is the quote about patience? That is relaxing the edges of time to make space for something else to arise. Relaxing the edges of time to make space for something else to arise. All right, so I want to talk today about this first parami of generosity. And the Buddha put generosity first on a number of lists, because in order to even meet our lives the way they are, to even come into a quality of, oh, this is what's happening, it requires a willingness to see, a willingness to be with, which is inherently generous. So there are various lists that begin with generosity. And he says, if our dana, if our generosity is not in order, there's no space for the rest of it to unfold. So understanding that generosity both is internal and external. I want to start with another poem, because I think that this is very valuable. This is called The Facts of Life by Padraig O'Tooma, who's a brilliant Irish poet, contemporary. The Facts of Life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie, if only to yourself. That you will get tired. That you will learn most from the situations you did not choose. That there will be some things that move you more than you can say. That you will live, that you must be loved. That you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention. That you began as the fusion of a sperm and an egg of two people who once were strangers and may well still be. That life isn't fair, that life is sometimes good and sometimes better than good, that life is often not so good, that life is real and you can survive it. Well, survive it well with love and art and meaning given where meaning's scarce. That you will learn to love with regret, live with regret, that you will learn to live with respect. That the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constricting. that you will probably be okay, that you must accept change before you die, but you will die anyway. So you might as well live, and you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. Padre Gotama. Could you hear the Dharma throughout that poem? That you were born and you will die. You might as well love. This is it. This is what we're talking about, is that because life is fundamentally difficult, because of the truth of dukkha, because of the truth of impermanence, the poignancy of that, the pain of it, the beauty of it, because everything we do is connected to everything else, you might as well love. Which is why these paramis are so important, because they are teaching us how to love. They're giving us all these different entry points into love. Generosity is an entry point, morality, renunciation, patience, truthfulness, etc. And we start right where we are. And the reason I said, okay, here's the list. What's alive for you? Where's your entry point? Where is the closed door? It's because we have all these choices about how we can access love, how we can cultivate it and tend to it. So we come back to the truth of the Four Noble Truths. We can think about the Four Noble Truths, which you know, that life includes suffering. There's a cause of the suffering. There's an end. And here's the path leading to the end of suffering. And it's right in this first teaching of the Dhammapada that I read earlier. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. Whatever is happening here, this, how we can cultivate, create our own suffering if we're not paying attention. But speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. That's the reliability of contentment, of peace, of non-suffering, when we start with peaceful mind heart. And that's not always true, and we know that, but this is this training. Ajahn Brahm is a monastic. I believe he has I think he's a British born monastic in the Theravada tradition. And I believe he has a center in Perth, Australia. And he's very funny. If you ever read his work, Ajahn Brahm, B-R-A-H-M. And he has flipped the Four Noble Truths of Suffering on their head. And here's what he says. These are the Four Noble Truths of Happiness. There is happiness. There is the cause of happiness. There is abiding happiness, and there's a path leading to abiding happiness. So let's take that apart. There is happiness. He teaches that this is our birthright. It's our innate capacity that we are wired for happiness. And, you know, with all of the neuroscience that's been done on what's happening with mindfulness in the brain, that we come into this world a pretty blank slate. We are wired for happiness, but so much gets in the way. And of course, we have our genetics and intergenerational traumas. But what we are doing in this practice is coming back to that innate happiness that is here, that ability to be okay, I think, is what we're working towards. There is a cause of happiness. And I think the heart practices are a cause of happiness. Generosity, morality, getting unstuck, this renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, equanimity, all contribute to our contentment, this cause of happiness. Deng Xiru, who was a 12th century poet, he says, the heart is a gold field. Plow it for 100 generations and it's never depleted. Goodness is a perfect treasure. Use it for a lifetime. Some will still be left over. And you know, the thing that's so beautiful about that piece is that the more loving we are, the more generous we are, the more truthful, the wiser we get. All of these components, all of these paramis, they don't get used up. You know, they just don't get used up. They are self-generating. And it's so hopeful, isn't it? That you don't have to worry about letting go of what you don't need or being generous, showing up for somebody, caring. You're not going to use up your heart that way. Now, there is compassion burnout. We know that. But that's not what I'm talking about. That this is a self-generating heart, the more we cultivate that. There is abiding happiness, same thing as there is an end to suffering. When the mind subsides, right, when that clench loosens up, we can substitute the word contentment for happiness. At easeness, okayness. We're not talking about Hallmark happiness. We're talking about a quality of being okay within the ups and downs, that our fundamental contentment and okayness doesn't need to be, isn't necessarily shattered by difficulty. I mean, we learn to ride that. Because what happens as we have more stability, we're cultivating more and more sati, which is the Pali word that is often translated as mindfulness, but Bhikkhu Anālayo says that sati is actually translated more specifically as a soft receptivity of mind. And it's the soft receptivity of mind that needs to be cultivated and present for the mindfulness to arise. Because in a constricted mind, it's hard for awareness to breathe, right? Because when the mind is in a clench, out of fear, out of startle, out of normal things that happen, we don't have as much perspective. But we're training in widening the perspective, this zone of resiliency, so no matter what happens, we have resources. And these paramis become resources to draw on in many respects, in many experiences of our lives. So there is happiness when the mind subsides, when it can accept, when it can allow whatever's happening to be happening. And acceptance and allowing doesn't mean agreement. I want to be clear about that. There's moral injury. There are things that are really, really wrong. So this is not a moral acceptance, but the sati, this abiding happiness, this end of suffering, really is this wide open space where patience says, what else is happening? How else can I be with this? And this last, the fourth noble truth of happiness, there is a path leading to this abiding happiness, the Noble Eightfold Path, the paramis, the Brahmaviharas. So specifically, the Noble Eightfold Path, just to remind you, wise understanding, which is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, of dukkha, of that everything is connected to everything else, karma. Wise intention, which we've spoken about a lot. Wise intention is how we go forward. And it's comprised of loving kindness, compassion, and renunciation, makes up wise intention. Wise speech, right? You know, being really careful that our communication is as mature as it can be and takes a ton of work. We all know that. Wise action, our commitment to non-harming. Wise livelihood, how do we make a living? Does it harm us? Does it harm others? That's a very long subject also. Wise effort, as we discussed. Wise mindfulness. Wise concentration. How are we paying attention? What are we paying attention to? And all of them are reflections of each other and 100% mutually interdependent. So you can start anywhere with any one of these paramis, with any one of these path factors, and end up exploring all of them. So practice is a really a dedication to goodness. And goodness is a medicine, an antidote to pain, and a source of contentment. And this is why cultivating these paramis is, I think it's vital. It gives us so much clarity. And I do think it keeps us on track ethically. That once we start understanding the value of understanding, but actually doing, I want to go back to what David said about making amends and the delight of the heart of that. It takes courage to do something like that, but the delight that is there, the release, the love, the generosity of that kind of thing, it's not small. It actually leads to the fruition of a lot of love. Cheryl Strayed, she said, "You'll learn a lot about yourself if you stretch in the direction of goodness, of bigness, of kindness, of forgiveness, of emotional bravery. Be a warrior for love. Be a warrior for love." And it takes all of these components. We need the paramis. We need the Brahmaviharas, metta, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. And you can see how these end up on different lists because they're so important. They come up over and over and over again. So we begin with generosity. And I have three more pages of things I wanted to bring in for you today. There's no way that's going to happen because it's such a big, long exploration and it's so much fun. So let's just talk about that. Generosity is complex. That for some of us, it's a good friend who's been with us for a long time, as Lily said. And for some of us, it's scary. And it can be that what our relationship is to generosity, this big continuum line of how we experience prosperity and how we experience scarcity. And all of us have that, ways that we have been raised with prosperity or scarcity or both. And if you imagined a continuum line, where would you place yourself on that line? And so for some of us, we are naturally afraid of not having enough because maybe we were raised in a family where every slice of bread was counted, every piece of fruit was counted. That's a real thing. And so that informs how we are. Or maybe we're raised in a family where we never give that a thought. There was always food. There was always plenty. There was no fear of what happens if the rent isn't paid. So we have all these different experiences, and it can be prosperous in love or scarce in love. You can apply that to so many different things. But the practice of generosity, I think, begins with a generosity towards ourselves. The fact that you are here is an act of generosity. The fact that you are willing to study your own mind heart, to come back over and over again, to learning about how you operate is a beautiful gift to yourself. And by extension, it's a gift to everyone else. So the practice of dana, whether, you know, the way you support others is also really important. But really, we begin with turning towards ourself, a quality of self-acceptance, caring for ourselves in the same way that we would care for others, remembering that we are the primary recipient of all of our actions. So let them stem from love. So we work with this piece of enoughness. And that can change over time, right? You may go through a cycle where you feel really sufficient and enough, or you may go through a time where you don't feel that because of different forces, different conditions that are happening. But the practice is to keep that wider view and to understand that generous acts are always in relationship, and you set yourself up for, I think we set ourselves up for more happiness, more joy, more contentment when we start with this generosity. And maybe it's material giving, but maybe it's really not, you know, material giving of goods, stuff, money, food. But it also might be our presence, you know, just showing up, a smile, opening the door, recognizing each other, walking down the street. Archbishop Desmond Tutu and His Holiness the Dalai Lama in their book, The Book of Joy, identify three primary areas of generosity, of the material giving, and then freedom from fear. I think that this is vitally important, to become safe for oneself and for others. When we give our time and attention, companionship, consolation, support, non-judgment, then we're not afraid of each other, right? And we can cultivate a kind of emotional safety, emotional intelligence, just by showing up, not needing to fix or change anybody, just to sit down with them. When our lives are aligned with ethics of non-harming, we become safe zones. And in that way, it's a generosity, because we're just here and we're safe. We send that message, I won't hurt you. And I know you won't hurt me. The third kind is a spiritual generosity of compassion. Of all these paramis, compassion, empathy, patience, listening, sharing, wisdom, not preaching. Not preaching for sure, right? We like to just hang out and be ourselves and cultivate kindness, but not telling anybody else how to be. And there's this old, it's not really a joke, but you've probably heard it in many Buddhist circles. People say, you know, my family loves me when I'm a Buddhist and can't stand me when I'm a Buddha. Excuse me, opposite. I totally blew that. My family loves me when I'm a Buddha and is so annoying when I'm a Buddhist. And I learned that lesson up close and personal. I was really thinking about generosity not long ago. And I said to my husband, who is not part, he wouldn't identify as a Dharma practitioner. And we were on a walk and I was thinking a lot about generosity. And I said, you know, the Buddha said da 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 da. And he said, okay, I want you to stop. He said, every time you start the sentence with the Buddha, I check out. Just tell me what you're thinking about. And it was a great reflection, because I know it in my heart and I can just be me and talk about how it moves me. And we don't have to rely on so-and-so said, unless that's the conversation and you're talking with people about what the Buddha taught, because that's the Dharma environment you're in. But it is a pretty quick way for people to turn off. So I learned that. So I don't do that anymore. But when we simply smile at somebody, what a beautiful thing to do, right? Just to see them. And, you know, I talk about this a lot when we talk about generosity, but I think this is really true. And the Buddha said this. So in our Dharma circle, I can say that and you will get it, that the Buddha did teach that generosity brings joy three times reliably. First, in the inclination to be giving, however, whatever that means for you. Second, in the experience of giving. And third, in remembering your giving. And I think that that's true. And so often we might get the inclination, oh, I think I would like to do da 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 da, some form of generosity. Do it. Try not to say, oh, later, I'll get to that next week. Actually do it when you get the inclination, especially if it's realistic. And then do it and notice how that feels. And then remembering sitting by the bedside of somebody who needed some help. Because again, generosity is in relationship. Whenever we show up for somebody else, we're actually showing up for ourselves too. So it's a beautiful thing about it, and it feels good. And the thing that's also cool about generosity is that Richie Davidson discovered that there's an independent circuit in the brain that is dedicated to feelings of well-being in the context of generosity. So when we are involved in generous acts, it actually stimulates a specific circuit in the brain that leads to feelings of well-being from either being involved in the generosity itself or even witnessing it, because we have mirror neurons. So you know how good it is to see other people treat each other well, which is an act of generosity. Maynard says, I love to regularly bring flowers to my yoga studio. What a beautiful thing. Yeah, feels good. Other people love it. And you get the joy of that. So another way that I want to go back to thinking about generosity in the wider sense of pain, in the wider sense of dukkha, of empathy, and what's actually happening in our world. So this is a piece that I read to you before, maybe last month or the previous month after the Mideast war started. And the question is, how do we hold empathy for everybody? And the trickiness and this, how hard this is. And this piece comes from Yuval Harari, who's an Israeli historian and author. And I bring it in again because as I was thinking about generosity, it brought in for me an expanded way of thinking about it. So here's what he says, and this is a couple months old. It was in Time magazine. For right now, most Israelis are psychologically incapable at this moment of empathizing with the Palestinians. The mind is filled to the brim with our own pain, and no space is left to even acknowledge the pain of others. And most Palestinians are in a similar situation. Their minds, too, are so filled with pain and loss that they cannot see our pain. But outsiders like us, like you, who are not themselves immersed in pain, should make an effort to empathize with all suffering humans, rather than lazily seeing only one side of this terrible reality. It's the job of outsiders to help maintain a space for peace. We here in Israel and in Palestine deposit this peaceful space with you because we cannot hold it right now. Take good care of it for us so that one day when the pains begin to heal, Israelis and Palestinians and you too might inhabit a space of peace together. The practice of holding a bigger space for those who can't hold it is an amazing practice of generosity. To say, I see your pain, and to actually, for the way Yuval Harari put this, we deposit this with you. So you can hold this empathy for us because we can't do it right now. What a beautiful request. And so when we open our hearts wide enough and let go of maybe, you know, the inclination to take sides, but open up wide enough to see the enormous suffering, and we hold a space of empathy and love and compassion. What an act of generosity. So it's another way of thinking about generosity is to create a really big space of love for all who need it. Because it will come back to us. This is how it works. Because if you've ever said to somebody, I'm hurting so much right now, can you just hang out? Or just wish me well. That's an act of generosity. I can't do it for myself right now because I'm so entrenched in what's happening. I'm so scared. When there's an active big trauma like this, we need a bigger community to hold it. I think this is an essential practice. And then we get to what Andrea Gibson says is, in the end, I want my heart to be covered in stretch marks. In the end, I want my heart to be covered in stretch marks. And this is why the paramis are so important. Thank you for the generosity of your presence and your attentiveness, truly. It's a pleasure being here. So we offer up the goodness of our practice together so that all beings everywhere have enough to eat, have shelter, a welcoming community, healthcare, so that we can come to the end of suffering. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you next month.
Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.